let's talk, let's wait for the next speaker. It's a doctor-to-be, Metzner, from MIT in Germany. Experiments to investigate photon nuclear coupling and related effects. There were new pictures for exciting and de-exciting atomic nuclei. Okay, you have 20 minutes, not enough.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So, my name is Florian Metzler. I work with Professor Peter Hagelstein and CN Liu at MIT, and we represent the Energy Production and Conversion Group. I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview first before motivating our work a little more so you have a sense where this is leading up to. So core our experiments involve a steel tank with a radioactive isotope, and we apply mechanical stress to that sample. And what we believe is happening, and I'm going to substantiate that, is that when the stress is applied, there's a delocalization of the photon emission from the plate for the lower energy lines, and there's a angular anisotropy effect of the photon emission for the higher energy lines. Okay, so how do we come up with this and why do we think this is happening? So let me take a step back, and this is going to be the structure of my talk. I will motivate this research, then talk about theory and predictions by theory, which inform the experimental setup. Then I will present the data that we took, and I close with the interpretation and next steps. So condensed matter and pure science really encapsulates real well what we're doing in this work. And you can approach it from two directions. One is from, you come from condensed matter physics, and you can ask yourself, what is it that phonons do? And it's well known that phonons can interact with electrons, and there's photon coupling, there's photon spin coupling. So almost naturally the question arises, what else can phonons do? What else can phonons couple to interact with? And you can also approach our work from the nuclear science field, you can ask yourself, what is it that can lead to the excitation, de-excitation of atomic nuclei? And here also conventionally, what is very widely accepted, of course, is that you can use photons to get nuclei in excited states, and also when nuclei fall back down into lower excited states or ground state, then they will emit photons, and you can also do this with energetic particles, and of course you change your nuclei in the process. So that's well accepted, but then there's this whole large literature on anomalies that suggest that there is a relationship or an impact of condensed matter environments on nuclear processes, and this actually goes back, at least I speak about the published literature here, goes also back before Fleischmann and Pons, goes back into the 1960s. There's also this emerging literature, really an emerging literature now on phonon engineering, or what's alternatively called phononics or nanophononics, which is really part of mainstream condensed matter physics, and or a subfield of that discipline. And I'm particularly interested in a paper here by Foltz et al., which is a survey paper by about 20 authors. And just to give you a sense of some of the language used in this paper, so people talk about engineering nanostructures to have better control over phonons. They emphasize the ever-increasing importance of phonons and even predict that some novel insights into fundamental questions of physics may result from this, so where the subfield is leading to. And so they recommend to establish phononics as a transversal research topic. And so I think it's really interesting to see this kind of dynamics and openness towards innovation from a mainstream field, and I think that may provide some opportunities to connect with. So coming back to phonon-nuclear coupling, so in response to some of the questions that are raised by the previous slides, different theorists have proposed an interaction between nuclei and condensed matter environments, and Professor Hagelstein, in particular, discovered what he called phononuclear coupling and later noticed that it can actually be derived directly from the Dirac equation for the multiparticle nucleus, and was already noticed in the 1930s, but was not further pursued because it was considered not relevant for the path of nuclear physics, accelerator-based physics, that was pursued at the time. So I'm going to skip over a lot of the theory stuff. I'm going to review it quickly. I wanted to have it in there, but I actually talked about this at ICCF 20 in Japan, and Professor Higginson, of course, talked about it many times. But I think my key takeaway point here is really that you have the many particle Dirac model of the nucleus, and if you apply the assumption that the motion of the nucleus macroscopically is non-relativistic and the motion of nucleons inside the nucleus are relativistic, then you end up almost automatically with this coupling, which is the Fermat nuclear coupling. Okay, so what does that mean with respect to the anomalies? One thing that's really helpful about this approach is that you can now quantify your phonon nuclear coupling. You can actually make models and determine the phonon nuclear coupling strength. And here's the simplest example where one just considers a molecule with a nuclei with two states. And you can see here how there's a matrix element that represents the coupling strength and how it's dependent on the phonon energy and on the nuclear transition energy. And you can do the same thing for a more complex system, for a crystal. You also get your indirect coupling matrix element, and you can determine your phonon nuclear coupling strength. So that is there, that sort of framework is there, and it can be modeled, but for us, and especially for experiments, the most important question is how strong is this coupling, how does it manifest, and does it lead to observable effects? And so from this perspective, the most important thing we can pull out from these calculations is what are the relevant variables. And so I list some of the relevant variables that come out of the models, and especially I want to draw your attention to the energy and excited phonon ones and the energy of the nuclei involved. And so it's a simple picture that kind of emerges from that in analog to the earlier pictures of excitation. De-excitation is this sort of excitation by phonons and de-excitation by phonons. But that may not be the best implementation to observe this effect experimentally, because mostly if you think about, for instance, the 14 kV state of cobalt 57, you would need an awful lot of phonons. And so there may be part of the reason why some of the effects described here are so difficult to observe, because if you depend on a large number of phonons in your systems, you may not always get them when you need them. And so the question that kind of emerges from that is, are there any effects or mechanisms that lead to effects that manifest with fewer phonons? And so here we come back to the modeling, and we come back to this a model of a molecule as sort of the simplest system. And if you start with excitation in your system already and you have the coupling, then your coupling strength goes way up and you need way fewer phonons for achieving the same coupling strength. So bringing that back to this picture, so you imagine you have a nucleus in a lattice, and it's an excited nucleus, and you generate phonons in the lattice. You create this sort of quantum system here, as the coupling is happening, and you can actually transfer the excitation to another nucleus if you have matching levels here with only the exchange of two phonons. So that's a much more sensitive system and much more likely or much easier to implement than the earlier sort of excitation from ground state system. And so if we take that into account and we consider now a system with where the energy, the phonon energy is given and the condensed matter environment is given, then basically the larger the nuclear levels are that we want to affect, smaller our coupling strength will be, and different effects will manifest. And I don't have time to go into the details here, but we expect to see anisotropy effects for the higher nuclear levels, and we expect to see delocalization effects for the lower nuclear levels. Here again, I use the levels as examples for the materials that we work with, specifically cobalt 57. Okay, so all of this leads to the experiments. And so we expect that we see some changes in photon emission in the presence of phononuclear coupling, of relatively weak phononuclear coupling. And we expect different effects for the different nuclear states that we're working with. Okay, so now to the experiment. So I already mentioned we use cobalt 57 here, the energy levels, and particularly there's a 136 and a 14 kV state that is important to keep in mind. Our sample is a steel plate where we evaporate cobalt 57. And here you can see a close-up of the source that's created in that process. This is a pinhole X-ray radiograph. Here is our experimental setup when we can apply the treatment, which again is the mechanical stress. So this is the schematic. This was the first embodiment of this experiment. We had a scintillation detector at the top and a Geiger counter at the top. We had an X-ray gamma spectrometer at the bottom, which had a range from about 1 to 28 keV. So what you really get in this kind of scenario, what you can actually measure, is the detector at the bottom sees the 14 kV lines, and the detectors at the top, they see the harder gammas that go through. Or they see, in this case of the scintillation detector, actually some X-ray fluorescence from the harder gamma on the backside of the plate. So here's some of the spectra. So this is the Amtec X123 gamma spectrometer, and then this one was not shown in the schematic. We later used some MorTec spectrometer that has a full range up to about 140 keV. Now I'm interested in the time histories. So if we take the X-ray spectrometer and we look at, for instance, here I have the peak, the tin X-ray fluorescence peak, and we have data here for about a month, and you can see how it declines with consistent with the half-life of the cobalt 57, which is about 272 days. So that's exactly what we expect, and everyone would be happy with this kind of data. And so on the backside, the Geiger counter here, you have a week's worth of data that also decays at the expected rate. Okay, so now we apply the treatment, which is we apply stress to the clamps, and we generate a stress field across the plate. Our first implementation of this experiment, which actually wasn't really an experiment, it was a sequence of experiments where we were looking for something else, and later we look back and notice this effect that I'm going to present. And I'm saying this because that explains why some of the data looks a little bit messy, and some of our detectors were used for the first time and still had some noise. But I'm going to show you better quality data that followed from that later. But the first observation was that instead of this expected emission, after applying the mechanical stress, we got an enhancement of emission from both the nuclear line here and also the K-alpha and K-beta, especially the K-alpha line, which also is an output outcome of some internal conversion from the nucleus, the nuclei of the cobalt 57. So also what we observed on the backside is after applying the treatment, we get in the center, we get a reduction of emission, and at the top, we get an enhancement of emission. And so that prompted us to try other variants of this experiment. So one thing we wanted to do is create stress in situ, because when you apply the mechanical stress in the early experiments, you had to take it off the rack and put it back on. And here we basically generate stress in situ by applying heat, raising the temperature, and the plate expands and presses against the fixed clamps. And when we do that, we can actually now correlate the temperature here, which causes the expansion, and then we can also see how the photon emission is correlated with the treatment. Again, here the K-alpha is also influenced by the internal conversion apart from X-ray fluorescence. Also note there's different magnitudes of the effect for the different lines that is part of the what Peter discussed as how the line ratio changes as part of the observation here. So here I just wanted to compare all of the different lines for this particular experiment. So you can see again the detector is actually working quite nicely. It's actually in this data was taken from this experiment over months. The tin alpha line, which in this case through X-ray fluorescence integrates over most of the harder gammas, is actually showing exactly what we would expect. And then later we moved on to investigate this hypothesis that there's some delocalization effects here. So we put a pinhole on top, we put an X-ray film on top, and we took X-ray images for 24 hours exposure. Here is a cold before treatment image, and here's a during treatment image. And created some heat maps from those. And so it's hard to tell by eye, so it requires some analysis, and we're very early in this process, so we want to do more studies of delocalization. But some of the things we noticed is when you actually cut through the image at certain lines, you can see a widening of where the ring, this ring is with a high concentration. But again, this is very early preliminary data. We need to get better data on this. This motivated us, though, to study with the X-ray spectrometer individual points. So here we're looking at this hotspot, which is an area of high concentration of emission. Here we get an increase of emission. Okay. And then we also study a spot outside the hotspot. And here we, again, this is very early data. It's not great data, but it's leading us in a certain direction from better experiments. But here we see a reduction, at least tentatively. This leads to some interpretations as to what's going on with respect to delocalization effects. So now returning from the lower gammas to the higher gammas, to the harder gammas, where we would expect weaker photonuclear coupling and therefore a rather angular effect instead of delocalization effects. And so this is one setup where we have two different spectrometers looking at different angles, and we can apply treatment through mechanical stress. So this is the schematic of the setup, again, focusing on the harder gammas. And so what I referred to in the earlier experiment was that what we may have seen with the reduction at the center and the enhancement at the edges, that we get angular anisotropy, but we need better data with better detectors. And so this is one experiment where we have the Ortec gamma spectrometer, we have a shallow angle, and we let the sample sit for a long time, and we apply no stress, and so that's kind of a baseline control run. And here we have just applied mechanical stress, and you can see there is a reduction at this angle with the two-time constants. So moving on from the data to the interpretation, the argument is that there's mechanical stress applied to the plate, which leads to dislocation movement and friction, which generates terahertz phonons. I think this is pretty uncontested. And then this causes photonuclear coupling, which then manifests in these different effects respective to the nuclear transition energies. So again, here, the interpretation is that there's a stress-strain field. We have ideas on how we can verify and measure that. And the interpretation of the delocalization, this is in particular from the early results with the imaging and the pinhole spectrometer setup, is that there's this hotspot on the plate, on the substrate, and excitation actually where there's lots of rancid iron 57 nuclei that can receive excitation from other excited nuclei, and that some of the excitation moves towards that hotspot. Again, that's the tentative pictures at this point. So that would, in terms of the schematic, that would basically mean, okay, so we apply the mechanical stress, we get the delocalization here, we apply for the lower, for the softer gammas, and for the harder gammas, we apply the mechanical stress, and we get the angular anisotropy effect. So the next steps are to basically flesh out some of the data and to get more data, get longer series, and get, for instance, with the angular measurements, scan across more angles. We want to do a high-resolution raster scan to get a high-resolution image at different energy bands. We want to do X-ray camera imaging. We want to have more systematic application of mechanical stress, and we have some ideas on how to create better samples that show larger effects. And then lastly, it's very important to create a concrete model for this particular experiment along the lines of what I referred to in the introduction. So here's some of the setup. We have this XZ stage setup, which can move at 3 micron increments, and we have a grid that we want to sort of cover for these measurements. We have a mechanical station that we're ready to deploy. We play around with some digital image correlation techniques to characterize stress-strain fields, and then we tried out different ways of creating new samples. So in summary, we believe that that we are seeing phonon nuclear coupling based mechanisms and effects in action, and that the observations are consistent with the picture I presented.
Thank you, Floyd. So we have time for one quick question and quick answer. No.
I'd like to acknowledge support from industrial heat for this work.
Okay, that was good. Short and good.
Is there any relation of what you call your finding with the most power effect?
Yes.
Can you tell us something about
that? I don't think it allows me to.
Well, actually, you're in the bus, I can tell you that. We don't have time, I'm sorry, because you have to take vacation this afternoon, so. In France, it is a must for vacation, so.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. And quick, sure, very quick.
Is your source is implanted in steel, or do you have to put that source on it? Just surface region.
Sorry,
the source is implanted in?
The source is evaporated, but we've also experimented with electroplating, so we want to also try electroplating, but for now it's evaporated.
Okay. I'll ask
how do you get a contact strength?
Okay. I think we should wrap up and thank Florian for his work.